my goodness, classmates. It is time for another episode of Art Class. Welcome to it. This is Lincoln Center's podcast all about decolonizing the arts and the arts industry. I am your host, Rocky Jones. And as always, I am here with my two amazing co-hosts. First and foremost, we have the stupendous, amazing, lovely, moisturized Paige Reynolds. Hello, Paige Reynolds. How are you today?
Hello. I'm feeling good, feeling great, feeling kissed by the Louisiana sunshine.
Ooh, okay. Love that. And of course, that other voice you hear is the equally stupendous, amazing, beautiful, and moisturized Dr. Lee Bynum. Hello, Dr. Lee Bynum.
Hello, Philippines.
Hello, Philippines.
Hello, hey.
Especially Marina Summers.
Get out of my head and stay out.
We have another wonderful jam-packed show, but I am still coming off the high of last week. So excited. We actually got to be together. Usually the three of us are flung across the country in three different cities, but we actually got to come together and in New York City at the David Rubenstein Atrium. And I said it right that time. I would just like a point. Thank you so much. And getting to interview the legendary Nona Hendrix and Nia Simone Edgerton and Sophia Edwards, who are two artists who are working with her on her Dream Machine project. And it was just, it was a time.
We had a time.
We had a time, y'all. We had a time. It was a key. Yes, it was. But it was awesome to just be in New York for a week and just to spend time with the two of you and reconnect in that way. And so I had such a wonderful time.
Me too.
So did I. It's always good to have you two on my home turf and on my own terms.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay.
Because all this kowtowing to the central time zone is killing me. It's killing me.
I see. It was nice to like just think about one time zone for a week.
It really was.
Yeah. And also, y'all are lovely hosts, the way you host us, Lincoln Center, and your team, Lee. Aww. We had a good time and witnessing y'all in action at the hip hop conference, too. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
Shout out to everyone. Y'all are killing it.
Yeah.
Well, on behalf of the team, thank you. Thank you for that beautiful acknowledgement. It was great to have y'all as a part of it. And for everyone to kind of be able to see how the pieces connect to the work that we're doing. I thought that was really amazing. And the conference that Samuel and Martha Diaz put together on hip hop education was fantastic. I learned a lot. I laughed a lot. I cried a little. It was all the emotions. Really, really powerful stuff. And we will certainly be doing something like that again in the future. And we hope to see everybody out there in here.
But we have a jam-packed show for you today. As I was saying earlier, we have part one of an amazing kinfolk with the incredible, wonderful artist, Sona Jabarte.
Yes. And,
yes. Am I saying that right?
Okay, you are.
And so, Paige, you want to talk to us a little bit about this kinfolk segment?
Yes, I'm so excited. I'm so hyped that this could happen. I mean, one, Sona has been on tour and so has been busy, a busy bee. But also just like who she is. She is the first professional female kora player. The kora is a very old instrument belonging to griot families of West Africa. It is like an instrument whose expertise is passed through families, passed down by certain families who do these traditions, and usually by men. usually passed down through men and more of like the storytelling singing part passed down through women. And so that is something that is changing, that she is a part of changing. And I was just so excited to talk to her also because the kora is in one of those instruments that is related, kind of like a distant ancestor to the banjo and relative to other gourd string instruments that Black people play all over the diaspora. So it was so exciting to just, you'll hear her talking about things that folks are talking about in our earlier segments, just from a different part of the diaspora, but it's all connected. We're all doing a similar decolonization, reclamation kind of work. And so it was beautiful to see that. And to you'll hear her even speak to those connections and what it's been like to be touring across the United States. So,
yay, I'm excited for y'all to listen. I'm so excited. I can't wait to hear it.
Yay, and then, I can't wait for y'all. I can't wait for y'all to hear it too.
And then I'm super excited because we're also, I feel like we're kind of going back to our roots a little bit. So, you know, if you are a fan of us, you should go and check out our previous show, The Score, which we did for 50-something episodes over the last couple of years. And back when all of us met, we were working for Minnesota Opera. And so The Score was really talking a lot about the problems with the canon, the operatic canon, talking about equity issues in classical music. And so I'm super excited to go back and revisit those topics with friend of the show, Julia Bullock. Can you believe? For some reason, she is taking a second chance on us. Go back and listen to her episode of The Score. Fantastic, amazing. And of course, she's done so many incredible things since then.
So many.
Winning Grammys and making her Met debut in El Nino tonight.
Tonight.
Incredible. But we just had a really, really great conversation. And of course, the canon, the operatic canon. I'm exhausted when I think about it. I get so exhausted when I think about it. But I mean, there are some, you know, for those of you who perhaps are not familiar or haven't really sort of gone in depth with some of this thinking, there are some definite issues. And I think there are like seven that, you know, are the biggies, right?
Absolutely. Seven major ones, although each of them probably could, you know, be subdivided into several others. The first one and most obvious one is the general lack of diversity. The most prominent composers that people are exposed to tend to be white, cisgender, heterosexual men from Europe who have been dead for a century or so. That's connected to the second broad issue, which is just Eurocentrism, period, in the entire genre. There is a way that France, Italy, Austria, Germany, and Russia are just overrepresented relative to perhaps their populations to the rest of the world. Lots of issues with accessibility. A lot of that is around socioeconomics, right? Perceptions of opera as elitism, as elite rather. But there are also issues with other kinds of access, given language barriers, the length of time that it takes to sit and listen to an opera, even conceptually in the physical spaces of concert halls, they can be very hard to maneuver if you have challenges with mobility simply because they were built so long ago. Gender bias, right?
Yes.
Women compose, women conduct, genderqueer people compose, genderqueer people conduct, right? You don't usually see or hear much of that. One of the bigger ones for me is like the general lack of historical context that is present in interpretation. People love to wrest things out of their context and act as if in presenting music that they're not also presenting things about culture, that either our perspectives have shifted. Maybe everybody doesn't think the Crusades were a good thing. Maybe some of us find imperialism challenging. Also, economic challenges with opera. It is super expensive to produce. And that really affects the ticket prices, where it happens, who thinks of having ownership of it. And then lastly, stagnation, right? There's a lot of repetition. There really are only a couple dozen operas that are commonly performed. And does that allow the art form to grow if there is not a constant flow of new material, new ideas, different ways of thinking about the same material? So in our roles here at Lincoln Center on the education side, we've been thinking a lot about how we address that, right? This is not necessarily a, we're going to toss the baby out with the bathwater, which I've always found to be a weird visual. But instead, we're really thinking about what mechanisms do we have available to us? So generally, there are four ways people address these challenges with the canon. Diversifying programming, right? Literally just bringing new kinds of things in, things from other cultural traditions, or supporting new works, commissioning new works by new artists, obviously living artists, if you're going to commission them. But also, and please take note of this, those of you who work in contexts where you program or curate things, there is an importance in not erasing the existing, living, hardworking, talented, underrepresented composers who are already out here, who are well-trained and working now, but are not necessarily household names, right? Every time we're commissioning, we don't have to go outside of the existing apparatus of classical music, because there are also underrepresented people already working within the space, right? Thirdly, reinterpretation and contextualization, right? Like there may be ways to approach works. I have always been fascinated to see what Madama Butterfly would look like if the creative team were women of Japanese descent, for instance, right? And what would that agency moment possibly look like for Cho-Cho-San? And then lastly, education and outreach, literally training people differently. And in the fall, we are launching a program at Lincoln Center Education. It is called Compose the Future. I am very excited about it because it is a program for younger kids, really middle and high schoolers who are interested or even thinking about becoming a composer. And we are really thinking about the full wraparound experience where we're not just going to teach the art form, but we're thinking about how we socialize underrepresented kids to something where it hasn't always been open to them, how we professionalize them towards what the job will actually look like, providing mentorship, leadership development, making the program broadly accessible, irrespective of people's neurological and physical dispositions and abilities, and really thinking a lot about mental wellness. We've been working closely with some folks like Ellen Reed, Missy Mazzoli, Inkiru Okoye, Curtis Stewart, Melissa Ngan, and the great Jonathan Hayward to get some perspectives about how we can do this correctly, right? And everything we do in art class, every person we talk to here and that we talk to on the score, I keep detailed notes, and these become ways that we think about how we are going to launch the program to do something very different than what has been done before. And it's helpful that it's coming in a moment where I am in an active commission and getting to think about what their job looks like for a person who's actively doing the job, at the same time as thinking about how do we create a program that can really support those of us who don't fall into certain categories, and really have our art be developed and nurtured and honed and appreciated in ways that are also resonant with who we are. We shouldn't have to change who we are as humans to be able to have our work performed and appreciated. So that's just a little bit about what we're doing here. And frankly, the conversation we had with Julia a year and a half ago really got me thinking a lot about what is the responsibility of educators to make something different for composers. So I'm super excited for this conversation and super excited to continue it in part two when we have Lacolie in Washington on the show in just 2 weeks.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for breaking that down. I think that's a really, really wonderful framework for people to think about as we go into this conversation. And if you are interested in hearing much, much more about this. Yeah, go ahead, check out the Score archives. I'll put a link in the show notes. if this is your bread and butter, you are about to eat.
Uh-huh. Yes, please do. And also, you can reach out to us directly on the podcast, or shoot me a note, mm-hmm. because I love thinking and talking about this stuff. And frankly, I am nothing if not didactic. So opportunities to chat about the kinds of ways that we want to address this and what other folks in the field are doing. I am literally always interested in those conversations.
Artclasspod@gmail.com.
Send us mail.
Yeah. Hit us up. But in the meantime, while you're crafting your brilliant your brilliant emails and wonderful questions, I invite you to sit down, turn up the volume, and enjoy this wonderful conversation that we have with the brilliant, legendary, talented Julia Bullock. Right after the break, we'll be right back. Right, everybody, we are back. Welcome back. And I cannot believe that our next guest it has returned. I think we can officially call you a friend of the show. I'm so excited that we have our next guest here. Of course, living legend Julia Bullock. Welcome back.
Yay! Oh, a friend of the show. Well, I'm honored.
Well, of course, Julia needs no introduction, but I will give her one anyway. An American classical singer who communicates intense, authentic feeling as if she were singing right from her soul, Julia Bullock has been hailed as an essential soprano for our times, combining versatile artistry with a probing intellect and commanding stage presence. She has headlined productions and concerts at preeminent arts institutions around the world. A prominent voice of social consciousness and activism, Julia is young, highly successful, and politically engaged, with the ability to inject each note she sings with a sense of grace and urgency, lending her performances the feel of being both of the moment and incredibly timeless. This season, she's looking forward to a number of operatic firsts. John Adams and Peter Sellers' oratorio El Nino is the vehicle for her Metropolitan Opera debut. Hey! In a new production led by Maren Alsop, marking Bullock's debut at Barcelona's Gran Teatro de Liceu, which I'm sure I just butchered. She stars opposite Gerald Finley in the European premiere of Adam's opera, Antony and Cleopatra, and just so many incredible, wonderful things we cannot wait to see. And of course, when not doing all of that, she's out here winning Grammys, excuse me, best classical solo vocal for Walking in the Dark, and so much more. We could not be happier to have you on the show. Thank you so much, Julia, for joining us once again.
I love being with y'all, so it's great.
Well, we actually just missed you by a couple of days. All of us were just in New York. We were just as gobsmacked as your son seeing your poster or being unveiled outside the Met. And so I just want to know, how's El Nino going? What can you tell us about the production, about rehearsals, and what can the people expect?
Yes. Honestly, we're having just a great time, the whole team. And this is the first time that I'm performing the piece in any sort of operatic staging. El Nino is the first piece of John Adams's that I ever performed. I think it was 7 years ago. And then a few years after that, I decided, because many places were either canceling the concert performances of the piece because the demands were too large and in terms of cost for the arts organizations. So I asked John and Peter Sellers' permission if I could take their 2-hour piece and distill it into a chamber music version for 4 soloists instead of 6. Again, chamber ensemble, and then the possibility of a choir, a small chamber choir, And so there's, it's an hour long piece and it's called El Niño Nativity Reconsidered. So yeah, this iteration of the piece at the Met is the first time that I've sung it in its complete original version. And then to have it fully staged is so, so beautiful. And that the entire cast is brilliant. There's also a group of dancers on this show who are just some of the most scintillating, charismatic performers with whom I've ever shared the stage, and just great artists in their own right. And then the director, Liliana Blaine Cruz, is just, yeah, she's just a friggin' delight from top to bottom, left to right. So we're having a really, really good time working on this piece all together, which is dense in all the kind of best ways. And the staging and also just the look of the piece in this iteration is densely colorful. That goes from the set to also all of the artists that are on the stage. It's very cool.
So for people who aren't familiar with the piece, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, of course. Sorry. So it's the Nativity story.
Yep.
And the difference, though, is that this Nativity story, which we often, many of us have been exposed to the story through a predominantly patriarchal Western European lens, but El Niño shifts that perspective and asks us all to center on the experiences of the birthing parent, in this instance, Mary. And, you know, along with celebrating all of the miraculous aspects of the story, like conception and gift giving, and, you know, just, yeah, these things we just want to celebrate as a part of human existence, it also asks us to grapple with some of the most difficult parts of our history as collective human beings, and very poignantly looks at genocide and forced displacement, which unfortunately are still realities that we're dealing with today.
Indeed, indeed.
I am really interested in El Niño and pieces like it that are, you know, that are reimaginings of a story we all know, and especially those stories that we all know, but maybe don't necessarily feel connected to. A common thing, especially in opera, that many of us have faced. And I'm wondering, as a performer, like, how do you navigate that? And are you specifically like seeking out stories like this, or and like why that is just like so important to be active, proactive about?
Well, I guess I have been seeking out stories like this or projects like this, even if I didn't know that I was. And I mean, just to use El Niño as an example, when I first listened to this score, over 10 years ago, I was still a student at Juilliard, and I was being asked to consider whether I wanted to even sing the piece. And so I went to the Juilliard Library with the CD that was recorded in 2000 or soon after, and just with a score in hand. And within, I think, 30 seconds, tears just started streaming down my face. And I didn't even really know why yet. And then, you know, my heart then just started racing, and then more tears started flowing. And, you know, it was only after listening to this 2-hour work enclosed in a Whitney Center at conservatory, and then looking at the translations and where the source material was coming from. So it wasn't just these selections from the Bible and the King James Version of the Bible, but it included poetry by Latin American women and parts of the sacred text that also had been taken out because they were considered too radical or fanciful. And wow, I just, it it was like, oh man, the impact that it had just listening to the score on my body, on my psyche, was immediate. And then to consciously clock that maybe that's why, it's like, that's that was very, very cool. I do think, you know, considering the historical canon that many opera houses and many performers and audience members are asked to look at over and over and over again, most of these opera composers and even librettists, I feel, were trying to center the voices and stories of people who had been neglected or cast out by certain parts of society. If we consider Violetta and La Traviata or Madame Butterfly, many of the characters, and you know, in Puccini's operas, it's like these are people who, and mostly women, who were subjugated and demoralized, but then placed in the center of these stories. The difference is, though, you know, women were not writing the words from the women, and the sounds of that women might set to music. It's like those were not immortalized like the characters were immortalized. So while John Adams and Peter Sellers are two white men, you know, thinking about El Nino, they took it upon themselves to expand their experience and their preconceptions about the stories that they want to tell with, I think, great sensitivity. So yeah, Paige, I think it's just the responsibility for any of us looking at pieces that already exist, or if we are involved in creating quote unquote new work, that we are not divorcing any parts of ourselves from interpreting the work really and considering every aspect of it really critically. Yeah. And yeah, I really only want to work with people who are functioning in the same way at this point in time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true.
I love what you're saying about responsibility and accountability, because I feel like it frequently just falls out of the conversation that all of us who work in this sphere have a part to play in advancing the art form and keeping it fresh and relevant. But I'm curious, when we're thinking about the existing canon, right? And the kinds of roles that people may choose to offer to you, how do you navigate these issues around representation and diversity and maintaining your own authenticity and personal values in the process?
Well, I research everything pretty deeply before agreeing to do a project. I try to understand the terms of how we're going to get the thing done. It's like, you know, if I genuinely feel there's enough time to invest, and in terms of diversity and representation, it's like, I think one thing that helps any work be a success when there's a group of people coming together, it's when you have diversity of thought in the room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for better or worse, and I don't know if this is, again, just seems to be sort of a reality of our world, but if you are a non-white person, you almost guarantee there to be a diversity of thought in the room. Yeah. Because the experiences that many of us have to go through who are non-white, or at least non-white presenting, there's just a whole range of we have to deal with. because I've definitely had a lot of experiences where I have entered the room and we're dealing with a subject matter that is touching on a particular heritage or culture, and that is represented in the performers, but it's not represented on the other side of the table. And yes, right. I have called that out, and I haven't always been invited back for the next iteration of the piece, but what is cool is that when the piece is done again, what I've seen is if the piece is done again, those changes are made. And so I really love seeing that kind of shift happen, whether I get to directly benefit or participate in it or not. And I am really happy to say that at the Met, both for this piece and then also for next year with Anthony and Cleopatra, I will be working with a diverse cast, and in every respect, the creative team is diverse as well. And yeah, there's certain things then that I don't need to ask for or explain. They're just offered and granted. And it's like that allows me then to feel comfortable and very, very welcome in the space. Yeah.
I'm glad that we are sort of landing in this space, right? Because we have been investing heavily at Lincoln Center in the development of artists who will be future leaders, especially around composing and directing, and really thinking about how companies may be run in the future and how we're training young people today to have a different set of perspectives so that it can look different in the future. From your standpoint, Julia, are there other things that we as educators can do to really bring about the revolution that could shift some of this fundamentally?
The rooms that I've most enjoyed in the past few years creatively are the ones where the sort of hierarchy that has been in place for centuries in this art form is shattered, essentially. Everyone, of course, has a responsibility to a project. The singers need to sing and learn their part. The designers need to design. But ultimately, it's about having an open conversation and communication with each other so that we can all get on the same page, all feel really excited about what we're offering and feel fully invested in what we're offering. And so there is time, there's enough time set aside to discuss things that aren't making sense. People can share their opinions without feeling shut down. And honestly, and again, we're talking about, again, just diversity of thought. It's like, and real collaboration between artists of various mediums, the work has benefited greatly because of it. And not just aesthetically about the look of the show, but I think it's impacted how the material, the musical material, is delivered. And as an educator, I am finding that the people now with whom I'm sharing most spaces, whether it's opera or concert, it's like many of them have education backgrounds when I say education backgrounds, it's like the times in their life that they really value are some of those, the years in school where they've been given space to create projects for themselves, or even if that opportunity hasn't been given within the school, at least it's with their classmates. And it's been like some of the happiest, well, certainly for me, some of the happiest memories of my time in school, because we're able to, yeah, become fully fleshed out artists we are, at least in those moments, and exercise those muscles. So I would say actually just providing students with opportunities to create even like small scale projects where they have to put together the material, organize all of the translations, maybe even find a place to perform, and just understand all the aspects that go into getting a piece of work on its feet. So that also you're appreciating everyone's roles and everyone's contributions once you get out into the field and people are being given a paycheck. It's like, it just, well, for me, it just really helped me appreciate all the human beings contributing. And it also unlocked this feeling of like, oh, well, if I'm not performing on stage, then I'm not an artist. I'm not a real artist. Because I genuinely feel that just about everybody who I encounter in this field has a great artistic voice, whether they exercise it publicly all the time or not.
Kind of a blend of your last answer and thinking about some of what we were just talking about with the canon, I'm hearing a lot about you know, a lot of it is our intention with the lens that we're applying, like really not being afraid to go there. If a piece is, for example, about revolution, how do we actually make that relevant and not shy away from its relevance and, you know, not canceling, but making space for reinterpretation. Mm-hmm. However, I do also wonder, are there things that are just like a limit of just like, no, actually, this is a thing that we need to do away with for real, or that like needs to stop, or whether it's the type of pieces being performed or the way that the work is being made itself, you know, like what are that are like, we actually have to stop. There's not space to reimagine.
Yeah. I mean, I don't need to see any blackface or ever anywhere.
Yeah, agree on that one.
I think whiteface is sort of interesting, but I don't need to see blackface anywhere.
Yeah.
I do not need to see the remounting of certain productions that are not giving the current living artists the opportunity to genuinely infuse themselves into, because there are times when I have been to the opera in recent years when looking at productions and it's like I can tell the performers are not happy. And or they're feeling torn or shut down. It's in their voices, it's in their body language, and it's just lame. It's just fucking lame, and it's such a waste of resources. So that can be done. I also am totally, I've written about this a bit and have spoken about it a lot, but I am so over any production, or honestly any opera house at this point, who does not hire intimacy coordinators for projects where there is intimacy of any kind or violence of any kind on stage. And, you know, really when we're just talking about respecting human beings who are asking themselves to embody tales that can be really scary, and they can be very, very hard on one's nervous system, that there's a technique for handling all of that. And I'm so happy and grateful to say that at the Met, even in this production for El Niño, there's not a lot of physical interaction or physical intimacy, but for every single moment, you know, I said, could we just bring in an intimacy coordinator for this? And there's one in-house now. So the next time that, you know, after we sketched out what we thought we wanted to do with the scene, we were able to call in that intimacy coordinator to come in and look at those key moments, which only last about 30 seconds. And, you know, that's between me and another adult, and also the moments between me and the other children who are in the production, because these, you know, they're full human beings too. Mm-hmm. And to make any kind of assumption about even a hand holding is now, honestly, again, just with what I understand and how people hold trauma in their bodies, and sometimes they're not even conscious of the trauma they're holding. It's like, it's just so important to be mindful about all of that.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. Because in Minnesota, we've started having intimacy coordinators on every show for a couple of seasons now. And I sort of understood it like as a concept and, you know, talking to artists and how important and impactful it's been for them. But recently we had the intimacy coordinator come in and do a workshop for the full staff so we could all get together and understand it together. And it was incredible just to have that permission to just like say no. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so often, you know, if you are in a space and you feel just sort of pressured to like do something or say something or whatever, just a simple exercise where we're pointing around a circle and you get to say yes or no as to whether or not you want to be engaged with. And for so many people, after just that simple exercise, it was so liberating for so many people. And so I can just imagine, you know, how that, you know, in a rehearsal room where you're dealing with, you know, sexual trauma or violence or something like that, just how wonderful and comforting that would be for a performer. And I don't understand why we don't all have it all the time. You know what I mean?
Honestly. Because also, you know, when we talk about the arts as, you know, giving us this space to communicate with one another, it's like that communication, it's not just because the music is ongoing and it's like you can hop on or off at any time or check in or out at any time. It's like, no. Like the rehearsal room is the space where we get to practice how to communicate with each other in the most healthy, helpful, respectful ways that honor each other fully as human beings. And again, when we're talking about places that are not genuinely understanding that, I find it not only a waste, but it's like a total perversion of what the arts are here for.
Absolutely.
And yeah, that shit can be canceled right now. So that can be
done, 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 done. Dead. Well, we are getting too close to time, but I do have one last question for you. And this actually was Emile's idea, our dear, dear friend. And she said to me, I think at the end of every interview, you should ask the guest, you know, you're creating all this beautiful work and beautiful art, but what outside of that is bringing you joy right now?
Oh, that's nice. Oh, well, I mean, it's not even the quickest, it's just the most immediate thing that's bringing me, person that's bringing me joy is my 17-month-old. And I just... I enjoy waking up next to this precious person every day, and I enjoy making snacks and reading books in English and in German, and singing songs and making up songs, and dancing to Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker in the middle of the spring. And and honestly, I mean, it is. So we're in the middle of Tech Week right now, which is, you know, can be really intense. And these rehearsals begin at like 10:30, but my day with this kiddo begins, you know, at like 7:30 in the morning. So it's like I've already had kind of a full day, by the time I enter the opera house. I was honestly worried before I gave birth, like, am I going to start feeling really depleted or lost or lose track of things? And it's not that I don't get tired, and it's not that I don't drop the ball on certain things, but when it comes to just trying to embrace moments that are really important to me, I embrace them so immediately. And it's not even hard. It's like, I grasp those moments and then also can let them go, I feel, with way more ease now. And it's that's bringing me a lot of joy. So, yeah.
Awesome. I love that. That's awesome. Well, Julia, you always bring us joy every time you're here. And I hope we get to do this again really, really, really soon. Thank you so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy day to come and talk to us. And El Nino opens April 23rd?
Is that correct? Correct.
Oh, wait,
that's
today.
And runs through April 23rd. Oh, is this today?
Yeah.
Yes, April 23rd, and then it closes May 17th.
Okay. So everybody, if you're in New York, go check that out. And otherwise, where can people check you out and what you're up to?
Well, my website is up and running. Go to just juliabullock.com. Instagram, it's at underscore Julia Bullock. And those are actually messages that I do read if anyone out there does want to reach out personally. Facebook,
Awesome. Well, we'll have all those links and everything in the show notes. Everybody go check out El Nino. And thank you so much, Julia. It's always such a pleasure when you're here.
For me too.
Good morning, classmates. It's Emile here again to bring you the morning announcements. I am your resident violinist with a passion for collaboration in the arts, and I'm here to encourage you to go experience live art. The following is a short list of events and experiences that we here at Art Class think are kind of cool and maybe you should check out. Today's conversation with Julia Bullock is perfectly timed, as this very evening, April 23rd, is her opening night in the highly anticipated opera oratorio El Nino at the Met. El Nino, written by John Adams, incorporates sacred and secular texts in English, Spanish, and Latin from biblical times to the present day in a dramatic retelling of the Nativity. This brand new production brings together three of contemporary opera's fiercest champions, all of whom make highly anticipated company debuts at the Met this evening. Maren Alsop, one of the great conductors of our time, who has led more than 200 new music premieres, soprano Julia Bullock, a leading voice both on and off the stage, and who you just heard speak with Art Class, and path-breaking bass baritone Devon Tynes. The fully staged new production also marks the Met debut of Liliana Blaine Cruz, resident director at Lincoln Center Theater, who received universal acclaim for her Tony-nominated production of The Skin of Our Teeth in 2022. Tonight's company premiere of El Nino starts at 8 p.m., and performances run from April 23rd through May 17th. It's worth mentioning here that I am a self-proclaimed superfan of Julia Bullock, and I am not the only one. I cannot be in the audience this evening for this latest premiere, and maybe you can't either, but we can still hear her captivating voice as Julia recently made her solo recording debut with the release of her album titled Walking in the Dark. This album, featuring London's Philharmonia Orchestra and conductor Christian Reif, includes a full orchestral performance of Samuel Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915, as well as a beautiful rendition of the spiritual City Called Heaven and songs by Oscar Brown Jr., Billy Taylor, Sandy Denny, and Connie Converse. The 2022 album won Julia a Grammy for Best Classical Solo Vocal and contains an excerpt from El Nino in case you would like a teaser before you go hear the opera for yourself. Finally, as this episode of Art Class delves into the world of opera, I would also like to highlight one other brand new work titled The Swan. The Swan is an opera by Tamar Kali and features a libretto by Harlem Stage Associate Artistic Director and Curator in Residence, Carl Hancock Rux. It brings to the stage the story of William Dorsey Swan. William Dorsey Swan was the first known person to identify as a queen of drag. The opera is set during Swan's detention and conviction in 1896 for keeping a disorderly house, a criminal charge often levied against those who ran brothels. The opera explores the interior of Swan's mind as investigation, scrutiny, and detainment begin to take their toll. The full work is still in development, but composer and performer Tamar Kali will present excerpts from The Swan May 3rd and 4th on the Harlem stage. The performance will feature Brian McQueen singing the lead role of William Dorsey Swan, and the program will conclude with a discussion featuring Tamar Kali and her collaborators, librettist Carl Hancock Rux and stage director James Blasco. As usual, if you'd like more information on any of the things I've highlighted in the morning announcements, check out the links in the show notes. And I'll be back next time with more cool live art for you to experience. Bye, friends.
Welcome back, everyone, to Art Class. Class is back in session. And today I am so excited for this segment of Kinfolk. This is a segment that connects the arts and culture of Africa and the diaspora. our diverse traditions, our diverse cultural heritage, but that connects us back to the root of our common Africanness. And today we have a special treat, the legendary, internationally renowned, world's first female professional chora virtuoso, Sona Jobarte. Welcome, Sona.
Thank you.
So Sona was born into a griot family from the Gambia, a tradition that dates back centuries. Sona is a living archive, and she sings in Mandinka, a traditional language spoken by one of Gambia's many ethnic groups, instead of in English. And that's really important to make Africans feel something, feel pride in their own language and playing their own music. You'll hear this in her recent release, Barinya Kumo. I listened to the whole album and it is beautiful expression of your cultural heritage and also just Pan-Africanism. She is also founder of the Gambia Academy, the first institution in the country to educate young Africans in their culture, their traditions, and their history alongside everyday academic education. Welcome, Sona. I am so excited to talk about all of this, to talk about your background. But let's first start with, you know, your background, your history, your lineage. You're from a griot family, one of the five griot families that play chora. And from listening to your interviews and knowing some of the history, it seems that women usually sing, and it's usually men playing chora. And that's what's pretty traditional. What is it like for you to be female in this space, and have you felt supported as you've broken from that norm? How did that start for you?
Wow, that question covered so much, like 15, 17 years or more, actually. So I might not be able to sweep it all in one go, but I guess the to start at the beginning would be to say that the journey for myself into taking up the chora as a female wasn't ever one that was done with the intent to be the first female chora player. Mm-hmm. In this context, it was a journey that was undertaken really just simply from the point of view of having a love and a passion for that instrument, wanting to play it and have an ambition to play it. I always was very much drawn to instruments in general. Never was attracted to singing at all. So I always say to this very day, even though I sing now, that I am still an instrumentalist at heart, that sings rather than a singer that plays. So that's something that I've just later come to. But my heart has always been in behind instruments and in learning how to play instruments. But the chora was one that always resonated with me more than any of the others that I have been through. Still to this day, it still is the main instrument that I feel connects with me on a very deeper level. So becoming getting to a certain age and then being female then became an obstacle more and more as I got older, because now I had to learn how to navigate a way to reconcile the fact that I had a passion that was not going to be an easy path. It was going to be a difficult one because of the fact that I was not the required gender to make that an easy path. And so I'd say that my journey really started in terms of that reconciliation. It started at around 17 years old when I consciously made that decision that the chora would be the instrument that I wanted to actually gain professional recognition for, rather than it being a private form of study. And so that then became my starting point of that journey. How does that look like? How can I achieve that with the obvious hurdles in front of me?
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, who was supporting that journey for you? Were there elders, mentors, teachers who were really central to your development?
So early years was always my elder brother. He was the student. He was a student of my father from before I was even born. So he'd already gained a lot of knowledge from my father when I came into being. And then he started to teach me when I was very young. So I had like very background knowledge of the Kora from a young age. And that went through, as I said, until my adolescent years. But then it then was very much my own decision to then make that something that I pursued professionally. However, from that stage, that mentorship passed over to my dad. That was a moment that I had to, approach him and just ask him, outright, will you teach me? Will you agree to teach me? Will you teach me openly, but with the knowledge that this is something that I am going to do seriously? So it was his acceptance and his agreement that he would teach me that then allowed me to take that important step and that important chapter of my life.
Yes. That's wonderful to have the support. And I think about your album as I was listening to it and reading about the lyrics. I felt very connected to how it reflects a communal view, a need for unity, a need for pride amongst Africans. And I just want to know, like, why was that important to you to reflect? And what was on your mind when you were writing Banyakumo?
Well, it took so long to actually finish that album. Again, I wouldn't be able to sort of say that was a concise state of mind, because it was over, I think, 7 or 8 years that album took to make. I mean, I was not working on it solidly through those years, but it was over a long, long period of time. But what was very important in terms of from the very inception point as a sequel to, it is a sequel to the first album, being Fasia. And Fasia, the title of that album talks about your male paternal heritage. Fa means father, Sia is like part of your heritage. So it really is a reflection, and I must say a homage to my paternal heritage, that obviously the skills and that I have been gained from the male side of my family, because that's all that one has to study from, right? So that was also paying homage to that, and the fact that it's come this far in that capacity, and also paying homage to the system, I think, in that sense of the hereditary tradition that has been going for so many centuries. So that was sort of my first step in that story. And so Banyakumo for me was now the next step. What's next, right? Now I've acknowledged what, laid the foundations for me to be able to be where I am today, but where am I going to take it now? And that needs to be a second step. It needs to be something that follows on from that. So Banyakumo was always with the intention of bridging or closing the gap between the performer, the artist, the musician. That means the person who talks about and the person who does, because I was getting more and more difficulty in trying to find that resolution between the two, where people know you as a performer, they know you as an artist, even they know you as a singer before you're a player, which I always say that because I've never seen myself as a singer, but that's the thing that people see most. And trying to raise awareness that music is not just a form of entertainment. Music actually has a very, very powerful role within society. It always has. And I'm harking back to that, trying to bring people back into the reconnection, even if we talk about it from the African cultural perspective, that music always has a very functional purpose within society, even to this very day. Obviously, there has been that graduation away from functional purpose, the more that time has progressed and the more that the music industry as a, as a business form has developed, and the encouragement for artists to really kind of think of music as a commodity rather than a social contribution. And so therefore, this is for me, I guess, doing both. It still is a commodity in a sense, because I'm selling it around the world. It's a product, it's a CD, but I'm also bringing back that remembrance and a call to accountability for artists to also remember their social responsibility, to remember that the fact that they have a platform, the fact that they have been gifted with that platform in whatever capacity it is, to treat that with responsibility and a sense of duty as well to the society, whatever society it is that you are from, to be able to contribute in some way. And so therefore, like I said, rather than having artists who are the people who are the spokesperson and then you rely on other people to do it, I'm saying we have to be the very people that do it. And we always have been. Mm-hmm. But that has been a very systematic dispossession that has happened over centuries. And so this is, for me, bringing that back again and calling, especially younger artists who are up and coming, and reminding them that this is something that they need to incorporate into the development in their journey as an artist in music, or in the arts in general, I'd say, not just music, but in the arts.
And we are back. Thank you so much, Paige, for that wonderful conversation with Miss Sona.
Oh, my pleasure.
Learned so much. Loved it, loved it, loved it. Tune in next time for the conclusion of Paige's conversation with Sona. And now it is time for us to land the plane. It is time for our final segment. As you all know, we like to end the show on a little note of pure Black joy, PBJ, a little snack for your soul. And this is when we highlight a Black person, place, business, art, piece of culture that is making us happy this week. And this week's PBJ comes from Paige. Take it away.
Yes. So my PB&J comes straight from our little trip to New York. It was lovely. I got to see some beautiful art outside of what we saw at Lincoln Center too. Shout out to my friend Brittany, who went to the Leslie Lohman Museum of Art with me. Brittany is one of my close friends from Howard University from undergrad. We've stayed friends, and she was happy to accompany me on this trip. So I wanted to go to the Leslie Lohman Museum because it is the only dedicated LGBTQIA+ art museum in the world, with a mission to exhibit and preserve LGBTQIA+ art and foster the artists who create it. So I was like, I'm in, let's go. We gotta go. We gotta go see this. But what specifically caught my eye was this exhibition called The Plural of He, that explores the life and work of Colin Robinson. Colin Robinson was a Trinidadian American poet, critic, and hero of social justice and sexual liberation movements in New York and in the Caribbean as well. He passed away in 2021. And after that happened, the museum commissioned works by 5 different artists to, you know, create work based on his life. So there was original artwork displayed alongside like archival things, letters from Mr. Robinson, like personal histories, some of his writing, some of his political writing. And it was just so incredibly beautiful. Through this exhibition, this is my first time learning who Colin Robinson was. So as someone who is, I know, I feel like I'm in a stage of trying to be really intentional about learning and uplifting Black LGBTQIA+ people, especially artists. It meant a lot. There was all kinds of work inspired by his life, including some Trinidadian like carnival things, and an artist that created a piece of like masquerade mass, if you will, to like, just inspired by his life, inspired by his work for queer people. And as someone who loves masquerade specifically, mm-hmm. and took a 2-year course on it. Yeah, shout out to Caribbean Yard Campus, where I got a certificate in Caribbean masquerade history and design. That it just really woke up that part of me as well. And I just loved it. I love the museum. I love the work that was there. I encourage everyone to go see it. And the museum is donation-based as well. So you don't have to go break the bank to go and see it. I mean, obviously give what you can if you got it, because it's important that we support institutions like this. Mm-hmm, but I do think like the access was also another really beautiful part of it. So go to the Leslie Lohman Museum, y'all. And especially go see The Plural of He.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Mm-hmm. Love that. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And we also, a little mini PBJ is when we were in New York, you and I, Paige, we did a little pilgrimage to Stonewall. And so that was a nice little bit of LGBTQ plus history as well, and had a little drinky poo inside. Took our pictures outside like tourists. And it was lovely. It was a lovely day. So.
Yeah. I don't mind looking like a tourist for Marsha and Sylvia and all the other heroes who did so much for us. So poured a little libation, took our pictures, said thank you. It was lovely.
Absolutely.
Amen to that.
Amen. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's going to do it, everybody, for the show this week. Thank you to Julia and Sona for joining us. Thank you to all of you out there in podcast land for being there. And thank you to everybody who came out on Wednesday night for our live show. It was such a lovely experience sharing space with all of you. And we really can't wait to do it again. It was so much fun. And thank you to everybody at Lincoln Center who made that happen at the Hear It Here Podcast Festival. And make sure you go check out all the other wonderful offerings at Hear It Here Podcast Festival at the David Rubenstein Atrium. I did it again. I said it right.
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. I got an A. Gold star for me. All right. We will be back in 2 weeks. Like Lee said earlier, if you liked today's conversation, you're going to love the next one, because we're going to keep going in the same vein, talking about issues in opera and classical music with Lacolian Washington. Cannot wait for that conversation. I saw him speak once at the Sphinx Conference a couple of years ago, and he was brilliant. So I'm so looking forward to that conversation. And in the meantime, everyone, rate, review, subscribe, all those things, 5 stars, please. And what am I missing? I think I got everything.
Tell me about some words of wisdom.
Oh, yes.
Probably yes, what yes, you're yes. going to ask.
Well, yes. Thank you, Lee. Any words of wisdom?
I mean, you think I would, since I just prompted you.
I mean,
right? I was waiting.
I was like, certainly they have something to say to the people.
Oh, dear. Maybe it's just be careful what you wish for. I guess that definitely sums that up.
Well, and support queer art. How about yes. that?
That's a good one.
Yeah. Shout to Megami.
I'm just saying.
Shout
I was
to Megami.
Say, yes. If you had told me that I was going to be a Megami stan in 2024,
honey,
she
wasn't on
that.
The bingo card, but it's only thing on the bingo card now.
All right, that's it. That's it. We have to leave. All right, thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Class is dismissed.
Thank you so much for checking out Lincoln Center's Art Class. The show is hosted by Lee Bynum, Paige Reynolds, aka Mabole Inawale, and me, Rocky Jones. The show is produced and edited by yours truly. Our artwork is by Patricia Sanchez Navarro, and our music is Dope Skeletons by Frequently Asked Music. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can really help us out by telling all of your people about the show, subscribing on your podcast platform of choice, and yes, leaving us a positive review wherever you're listening, but especially on Apple Podcasts. It's a small act, but it really, really helps us out, and we just might read your review on air. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit the Art Class page at lincolncenter.org, follow all of Lincoln Center's various social media profiles, and feel free to reach out to us anytime at artclasspod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time, and until then, class is dismissed.